Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ahlan wa sahlan, and how's it, dear Bayo, Beno, and various levels of Buzrukos? This is The Big Picture, and this is AB Dawji, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. So, how was your week, eh? Why are you looking so grumpy? We've been having lovely weather, alhamdulillah. Sometimes quite steaming hot here in Durban like today. I like it. I'm working on my tan, darker shade of dark brown. But I suppose we're always complaining, eh? Too hot, too cold, too this, too that. Bunch of moaners, that's what we are. Never satisfied. And speaking about cold, soon, dear listeners, I will be going from the frying pan into the freezer. Yes, on the 6th of March, I'll be jetting off to Norway, right up there near the Arctic Circle, North Pole. At last, when I say I feel on top of the world, I will be really meaning it, literally. Yes, as I told you before, I will be taking a group of about 50 people from Durban, Joburg, Polokwane, Middelburg, Cape Town to go on and see something called the Northern Lights. An amazing sight, a natural phenomenon right up there in a place called Tromso in the ice and snow. And I just checked now, the temperature there at the moment is -7 degrees. Yarr! I told a few old buddies who are coming with me to save on the trip by booking a one-way ticket. And to make them feel better, I told them that I will be taking all the ingredients to make some lekker kheer, just in case they don't make it back. just joking, eh? Or maybe not. So, you missed out on this trip. But are you packing for my Russia trip, my Uzbekistan trip, and Bosnia and Croatia trip, and the Middle East tour in June, of course, and Spain and Morocco also in June. And, of course, China. Whoa! Hang on there. Cancel the last one, my China, okay? Which brings me to a terribly, terribly traumatic experience I had this week. And it all started when my fro told me to bring a special ingredient that was required to make a Moroccan dish in a special pot I bought from Casablanca called a tagine. For a whole week, I tried all the spice shops in Durban, every one of them. None of them had this ingredient except the one in Sparks Road. You know the one opposite, you know whose house? I told the wife that I was not in the mood for tagine. Rather make some killer kalya or something. No, she insisted. We hadn't had this Moroccan dish for a long time. So I had no choice. I put on a long black kurta and a black scarf that covered my whole head, and right across my face so that only my eyes were showing. What a perfect camouflage, eh? Completely covered. I smiled at my very clever planning. I took an Uber. I left my car and I took an Uber to the front of that shop. As I got up ready to sneak into the shop, there was a massive, deafening screech. Sounded like 100 lighties doing wheel spin on a Saturday night in Springfield. Screeching sound. Birds fell out of the trees. People ran for cover. Dawji, hey, Dawji, yow, come here. It was a human siren. Halima Kala. I froze on the spot and like a zombie, Frankenstein, walked up to her veranda slowly. Hey, Dawji, where you was, eh? Long time I didn't see you. I heard you went again to Croatia. Hey, hey, watch out. I'll tell your missus you must stand you. I said, how are you, Kala? You okay? And she answered, what am I tell you, Dawji? I am so frightened, eh? So I was very curious, and I said, Kala, what you frightened about? And she replied, my nephew Imran was telling me all about the germs that is killing million people all over the world.
Now maybe it is already here in Overport. I'm so frightened, Dawji. I'm scared to go in my backyard.
I was very curious also, and I asked her, why are you scared to go into your backyard, Kala?
She said, because, Dawji, there's a big China guava tree there. Nice ripe China guavas, full. Array, I'll never touch one. I don't even go near that tree. Imran told me about this this Corolla thing, and I was so frightened,
At that point, my phone rang, and I quickly said to whoever it was, what? That's shocking. Wait right there. I'm on my way immediately. I rushed out telling Kala, I have to go, eh? I have to go. It's an emergency. And then I shot away. So, no tagine until I get the stuff from Morocco on the next trip. And I wonder what the person on the phone was thinking about what I said. But let's be honest, folks. This corona thing, is it the corona? Coronavirus is really, really scary, eh? Figures released indicate that up to this point, about 1,600 people have died already, and thousands others have been infected. Maybe the number of deaths is far greater. You know, I have a confession to make. Really, I have a confession. I'm not proud of it. It's a bad thing I did. Very shameful. Very shameful. I went into Cape Union Mart to look at winter, heavy winter jackets, and the assistant was taking me to see them. I was following the assistant. As we came near these jackets, a Chinese gentleman passed me and also wanted to see the jackets. Sure! I immediately changed my mind and decided that I don't need the jacket anymore. And then I quietly walked over to the shoe section and sneaked out of the shop, leaving the assistant wondering what happened to me. That was such a rotten attitude of mine that I ask all of you for maaf with tears in my eyes. Right. Just a quick story from the news. Quick story. This is from the Guardian newspaper. A 101-year-old Italian man who has been in London since 1996 was asked to get his parents to confirm his identity by the Home Office after he applied to stay in the country after Brexit. Giovanni Palmiero was told that he needed the presence of his mother and father. He's 101 years old, right? He needed the presence of his mother and father when he made his application in the office in North London. He was then asked to provide proof of residence for 5 years in the country, even though he has been in the UK for 54 years and the Home Office is supposed to be able to access national insurance and tax records. Palmiero came to the UK in 1996 and worked at a restaurant in Piccadilly and up to the age of 94 in a fish and chip shop until 11 o'clock at night. Yar. Huh? Did you get that? He worked up to the age of 94 in a fish and chip shop until 11 o'clock at night. He has been married to his 92-year-old wife, Lucia, for 75 years, and they have raised 4 children and have 8 grandchildren and 11 grandchildren. I don't know which is more fascinating, that the Home Office asked him to bring his mother and father, or whether it was the fact that he worked until the age of 94. And he's been married for 75 years to his wife, 92-year-old Lucia. Amazing stuff, isn't it? By the way, there was a mix-up on the computer. And instead of having him at 101 years old, on the computer they had him as 1 year old. Well, in the end, after many phone calls to the Home Office, it was all sorted out. Sure, nothing can beat our... Yes, nothing can beat our Home Affairs Department. Smooth and efficient, in and out in 10 minutes, no mistakes whatsoever. What a joy, eh? What a joy. Right. Let's get on to the serious matters. 11th February. 11th February, a great anniversary in the history of South Africa. The day that Nelson Mandela walked out of prison after 27 years. All the major TV stations were focused on this dramatic... Do you remember this? They were all around the world. we're focused on this dramatic event, a turning point in history, the fall of apartheid. Thousands heard him speak from the balcony of a building in the Grand Parade in Cape Town.
My fellow South Africans, I want to say that it is a great pleasure to be speaking to you.
Maybe he didn't quite say that, eh? And I still remember 30 years ago, eh? I think I was about, I don't know, 15 years old, or was it 10 years, I can't remember. We were crowded around the TV at my family's home in Port Shepstone. The moment was extremely moving. Very, very touching indeed. As Mandela and Winnie walked arm in arm, with one arm raised in a clenched fist, with cries of Amandla. I was blinking back tears. Yes, believe it or not, I'm just a big softy. What an exciting time it was. And also a very uncertain time. Some of our people packed up and ran off to Canada or Australia. There's an old expression that I don't quite know the meaning of, but it goes something like this. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. And I think that applies to Nelson Mandela. We were at a very critical time. Some say that it was a very dangerous time in our country, in the history of our country. White rule was giving way to black majority rule. Political violence at that time had gripped the country. ANC versus Inkatha, then we had the AWB in the mix. And of course, the third force, which was the hand of the apartheid state, the third force. The country was on fire and was threatening to burn completely down to the ground. And then cometh the man, as if he was tailor-made for that critical occasion. Tailor-made. Tall and handsome, a man of great charisma, powerful, extremely well-spoken, a lawyer, of course he's a lawyer, cheerful manner that he had, an engaging smile, he had a big flashy smile, a man who exuded authority, but at the same time had an avuncular demeanor. Oof, I checked up these words this morning. Avunc could be like anyone's uncle. He commanded great respect, but if you crossed swords with him, you better run. And you know, he reminds me of another towering personality with equal amount of charisma, and that was the boxer Muhammad Ali. Wow, I met him way back in the 70s. I spent some time with him, and I tell you, he had the same qualities as Nelson Mandela. What a wonderful personality. And he came in, that's Mandela, and took charge and told everyone to stop their nonsense. That and of course we had a reasonably peaceful transition from apartheid to full democracy, and everyone breathed a collective sigh of relief. Yes, of course, there were compromises. The whites who held the economy in their hands had to be given the message that they were part of the new South Africa. No need to run away. And then, of course, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission under Desmond Tutu, where people came forward and vented their feelings and confessed their crimes. And then, of course, we forgave, and well, we didn't quite forget, and we moved on. Before the first election, there were some TV debates. Before 1994 election, there were some TV debates. And one I particularly remember is the one between Mandela and de Klerk. Mandela and de Klerk. Let's see if we can put it on right now.
With this problem,
Mr. Mandela?
South Africa is not a poor country. As I have said, our budget this year is 126 billion rand. We also are going to reorganize the budget, restructure the budget, in order to avoid the wastage of a party. We will be able to use the country's resources in a more efficient manner and to prevent the corruption which is so endemic in the National Party government.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
Aggressive change where most of the funds of the country have gone have come to an end. We have committed ourselves to leaders trying to lead a style of life similar to those of the community. I am going to suggest that my own salary, if I'm elected as state president, must be cut. I am doing that, unlike the National Party government, which has attempted to pay large sums to the director generals when the poor people, when there are 5 million people unemployed, when there are 7 million people without housing. We are not going to live like circus. My friends in the National Party can do that. That's what they know.
A response from Mr. de Klerk.
Right. Well, did you hear that, eh?
We are going to
use the country's resources in a more efficient manner and to prevent the corruption which is so endemic in the National Party government. Let that sink in, for a few seconds. Mandela said that at that time. The old apartheid government of the National Party was corrupt, and now the new, and in the new democracy, the members of parliament will not work for themselves, but for the people. There won't be any fat cats. In fact, Mandela said that he will cut his salary in half. Yes, he was very sincere, of course. He was committed and concerned for the betterment of all the people of this wonderful country. So, over the past 30 years, what has been the score? Mandela's vision? What else he said? The gravy train where most of the the National Party has gone is gone now and has come to an end. The gravy train is over. Well, all I can say is that train is speeding along merrily. Thank you very much. All on board! All on board! Last call for the state capture train. And so, dear folks, we come to the great tamasha of Thursday, the State of the Nation address by the President. It was a circus. The EFF had one message. If you don't do what we tell you to do, then Cyril Ramaphosa. Cyril Ramaphosa. The whole SONA, State of the Nation address, function, how much did it cost? 2.1 million. That's right. 2.1 million rands. Listen, boss, how many pit toilets in schools you can replace with proper toilets for 2.1 million rands so that children don't fall into them and die? And the anonymous fellow by the name of Mutu from Unit 2, he says that the money spent in the toilets is of more value than what happens in parliament, because the same thing happens in both places. I'm just kidding. Maybe not. And Mutu also said that parliament on Thursday had many people in red overalls. Maybe half the people there should be in orange overalls. Mutu got a really sharp brain. But let's take a close look at the ructions that took place in Parliament on Thursday night. I think we'll look at it immediately after this ad break. Welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. And as I said, we'll look at the ructions that took place in Parliament on Thursday night. Of course, we expected the EFF to cause mayhem. Let me tell you this. It's all a carefully worked out strategy, a plan of action that has been right there, right from the start,
when the EFF was formed. These guys are highly intelligent and highly motivated. Never make the mistake of thinking that they are just rabble-rousers doing things willy-nilly without thinking. No, sirree. You'll be making a mistake if you thought that. You know the old saying, the proof of the pudding? Well, from a one-man show a few years ago, the EFF is now the third largest party in parliament, with a very big voice indeed. And why have they been successful? Because they appeal to the fed-up sector of society. And there are many people in the country who are absolutely fed up. They're battling. What's that Afrikaans word? Something fall. I don't think I can say it on the radio. Lots of people are marching. Lots of people are unemployed. Lots of people feel that they are not getting their fair share of this new South Africa. And many of them are young people. People are struggling and people want action. And the EFF is a party of action. In fact, Malema said it on Thursday outside Parliament. He says, hey, this is an activist parliament. So the EFF has tapped into this large number of disgruntled citizens. And these citizens seem to like the straight talk. Even the rough talk. Hey, Futsakwena. Calling people crude names and so on. It reaches people directly. What's that word? It resonates with them. It's all down to earth. They talk like ordinary people in the street. They connect with the people. So the EFF appeals to this sector of our society that wants action. And then there are also a whole lot of promises that are made of a better life for all. Some of the promises may be described as being extravagant, unreachable, and so on. So when you see the disruption in parliament, you may be disgusted and view it all as childish behavior by a bunch of thugs. But, dear listeners, be clear. This is widely applauded by many in the country and will get the EFF increased support in the future. You know, the very next morning on the radio, SAFM, I heard a 29-year-old, well-spoken lady say that what the EFF did in Parliament was perfectly in order. We need a shake-up, she said. So, there you are. One person reflecting the views of many out there. On the other side, we saw people walking into Parliament dressed to the T, poshed up like a walimajor. Fabulous outfits, hair all done up, all like top-class lanis. Top class. What was that Mandela said about fat cats? And after the EFF held up the proceedings for 97 minutes, our dear president delivered his speech. Nice, measured speech in excellent English. Sounded like he took it out of the freezer and sprinkled some dhania on it from last year. This was from last year. Sprinkled some dhania on it to freshen it up. No shame. I feel sorry for our Cyril. He's really trying. But there are people inside his party, some may call them chorwans, with long knives who got the same message for Cyril. Cyril Ramaphosa. And the country is going down the drain. And the poor fellow stands there like a broke Johnny telling us about great things that will follow. The state bank, the wealth fund, the NHI. Wow. So good, eh? He came on the scene as the new dawn. The new dawn. Yar. Looks like late evening, eh? With no electricity. Shame, I like Cyril Mota. I really like him. He got such a nice big smile. But let's move on to other things in Africa. And we are going to move to the Sudan. And on the line from Johannesburg, we have Sister Aisha Kaji. Sister Aisha Kaji is well known to the listeners of Radio Al-Ansar and Radio Islam.
And things are happening up in Sudan. But anyway, a little bit more about Aisha Khaji, just in case you don't know. She has been lecturing. She's lecturing here at the moment. She lectured in Scotland. She's been on Al Jazeera. She's been on CNN. She's on BBC, on our TV stations, national TV stations here also. A lady who really knows what's happening, especially in Africa. So, Aisha Khaji, welcome to Radio Al-Ansar and Radio Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for giving us of your time. I know you are moving house and you are very busy at the moment. So, let me ask you just a broad question.
Yes.
A broad question. What's happening in Sudan? And more especially with Omar al-Bashir, the former president. What's it all about? Unpack the whole thing for us.
Okay, well, as you know, Sudan currently has a transitional government in place, which is a mixture of civilians and members of the army, high command of the army, generals in the army. So it's a transitional government that will eventually lead to full elections, hopefully, and a proper transition to democracy after many, many years of autocratic government by former president Omar al-Bashir. So what you have is a situation at the moment where the transitional government, the transitional council, is trying to normalize Sudan's relations with the rest of the world, is trying to get Sudan to get rid of its pariah status, particularly in the West, because of the alleged atrocities committed by former President Omar al-Bashir under his watch and command. Among these, of course, perhaps most notorious among these, is the long-running civil conflict in the west of the country, the region of Darfur, where many observers, myself included, believe that a genocide was committed between 2003 and 2010. So there are demands from the groups in Darfur, the armed groups in Darfur, that before they will lay down arms and agree to a ceasefire and a peace deal for the medium to long term, one of their demands is that President Omar al-Bashir, former President Omar al-Bashir, should be handed over to the International Criminal Court, where a warrant for his arrest, as well as four other members of his government, his former government, those warrants were issued several years ago and have not yet been acted upon. So the transitional government in Sudan has basically said last week that they are prepared to hand over the former president and the others wanted on crimes, very serious crimes, allegations of genocide, of war crimes, and crimes against humanity, particularly for the role that they played in the conflict in Darfur, where a minimum, at a conservative estimate, 300,000 people were killed, and at least 1.5 million were displaced either internally or outside of the country. So that's the situation.
What's the chances of him ending up at the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, ICC, sorry?
The chances are pretty good, are looking pretty good at the moment. It's going to be a lengthy process. It won't happen overnight. But the head of the military head of the council, General Burhan, as well as the civilian prime minister, Abdullah Hamdok, who, by the way, lived for a long time in South Africa and is very well known to many of us in the field, both of them, both Mr. Hamdok and General Burhan, had said that they are willing to hand over Mr. Bashir and the others, that they will do so as soon as possible, and that justice, one way or another, whether it happens within the country or within the region or outside of the country, that justice will be done and will be seen to be done. And I think that's the most important thing. Given the number of people, the sheer vast number of people who were affected by the conflict, as I said, at a conservative estimate, 300,000 Darfuris dead and millions displaced. given that number of people, it's very important that for a peace to be a lasting peace in the region, that justice be seen to be done and that the perpetrators of the genocide are actually held to account.
So is the dust settling down? Is the country coming together? Is there a united voice there? We heard recently that there was some discord about Netanyahu making overtures to someone in the Sudanese government.
Yes, well, Mr. Netanyahu is well known for that. And of course, Israel is quite keen to acquire rights to some of Sudan's natural resources, particularly some of Sudanese oil. And my belief is that Mr. Netanyahu's approach was in that respect. Mr. Netanyahu has been quite successful with the southern Sudanese in normalizing relationships with South Sudan and Israel. But the northerners, who are mainly Muslim, are of course far more resistant to any ties with Israel. So it did cause quite a storm in a teacup a few weeks ago, but it's unlikely that there'll be a return to any kind of full diplomatic relationships with Israel, certainly in the short term, because the majority of the Sudanese people, and indeed the majority of the transitional government, would be opposed to such a move.
All right, well, we seem to be losing you there, Aisha, but jazakallah for your input and unpacking for us what's happening in the Sudan, and more especially when it comes to the former president, Omar al-Bashir. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Right, folks, let's... Ah, there you are. Right, so let me just give you some news. In fact, let me give you some dramatic breaking news. Unless you've already heard it, but you can act like you didn't. In September last year, Donald Trump invited Narendra Modi to the United States. There was a huge rally in Houston, Texas, in a stadium where Modi was welcomed by 60,000 cheering people, formerly Indian, I suppose, now settled in the United States. 60,000 cheered Modi as he entered the stadium. The whole big function was publicized as a Howdy Modi event. Howdy Modi. That's, of course, like a cowboy, you know. Howdy, howdy, partner. So it was publicized as a Howdy Modi event in the United States. 60,000 people were there. And a short while later, Trump arrived and was given a rousing welcome. Well, now it's time for Modi to invite Pagla to India. And on the 24th of February, that's next week, I think, Trump and his wife will be jetting off to India. And on the 25th, the next day, Modi will welcome Trump at a brand new massive stadium holding, it's a cricket stadium, holding up to 125,000 people. And that's in Modi's hometown of Ahmedabad, Gujarat. Wow, what a huge event, 25th of February. Donald Trump will be entering the stadium and they will be making bet. That's Modi and Trump. Guess what the event is called? What is that whole big event called? Wait for it. Wait for it. Remember, the first one in the United States is called Howdy Modi. This one is called Kemcho Trump. No, I'm not kidding, folks. This is going to be held in Gujarat. And it's called Kemcho Trump. You can go and check it out. Just Google it. Kemcho Trump. You know what? If I was given the chance to publicize the event, I would call it Jayati Salo Gadero. Anyway,
enough of this fun and laughter. Let's now see who we got on the line. There's something big happening this weekend on the line. We have Mustafa Darsot, who you are familiar with, and he's going to tell us what he's got up his sleeve. Mustafa, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, AB, and assalamu alaikum to all the listeners. Well, talking about what I got up my sleeve is definitely not a trump card. talking about Trump visit to Ahmedabad, you know, the thing is that they're building a special wall to block off a squatter area because it mustn't be in Trump's view when he visits the city. So speaking about walls, wherever Trump goes, it is a walls follow him, you know. And so that's also coming out, and there's been a bit of big uproar as to why, you know, why they put this wall now and when this money can be used for more important things. But anyway, the reason for your call is that we of tomorrow's event, inshallah, which is the Solidarity March against the religiously discriminatory CAA law of India, which was passed in December. We are appealing to all the listeners out there to please come out in your numbers tomorrow to the Durban Beach Promenade at the amphitheater in North Beach, which is in front of the Ilangeni Maharani Hotel. We are meeting at 8:45 a.m. sharp, whereby we'll address the crowd, and then we'll have a short march over from there to the paddling pools and back, and have a few more speeches, and then it will be over. But the whole idea is that we need to voice this is a human rights issue after all. It's not just religious in that sense, although it is focused on religious discrimination, in the sense that we as a community cannot be complacent and just let things, you know, be unattended to. Also, what we've learned from the lessons in the run-up and the preparations to this event, we started over three weeks ago, that this is the first time that when we applied to Durban Metro for permission, that we ran into stiff resistance. Even when we planned for Palestine marches, or marches against the American consulate, we never had this issue. But for this one, AB, it's unbelievable. And the problem is that there are foreign nationals who are here in South Africa from India, and they are, trying to drive up an RSS agenda, and they are trying to lobby efforts and trying to block things. And unfortunately, our local community, especially those that are in the ANC and in the city council or in the metro, have actually been duped by the fake news and by the negative hype that they created about this event. This is not a hate event. This is not an anti-Hindu event. It's not even anti-India. It is against the law that violates human rights. And that's what we need to get out. So please, I'm asking to all the listeners, come out with your numbers, inform your non-Muslim friends as well, bring your families and come and let's show our solidarity against what the BJP is doing in India at this moment in time.
But India is spoken of as a vibrant democracy, and it seems like some people are less equal than others. What exactly is the implication of this law?
Okay, the implication of the law is, you see, the thing is that you have to look at the entire chain of events that has happened since the election victory of the BJP at the end of May 2019, that one surprise after the other has come about. It started off with the Kashmir issue on the 5th of August with the revocations of Articles 370 and 35A. Then it was the Assam matter whereby started, which was the build-up to the Citizenship Amendment Act known as the CAA, where 2 million Muslims in the state of Assam were stripped of their nationality because they could not prove, they did not have birth certificates to prove that they were born in India. Now, the thing is that most of these people are illiterate poor. I mean, we know here in South Africa, when we see poor beggars coming to us, whether it's in Ramadan or those on street, standing in the street corner, ask them for an ID or a birth certificate, they don't have it. Right? So you're talking about this sort of thing, and too many people were stripped of their citizenship. Then you had the Babri Masjid ruling, and now the Citizenship Amendment Act. And the problem is that the government of today is being more daring, and they are passing, you know, they are passing these laws one after the other, or they're making these changes to the constitution one after the other, and they were basically trying to show that they're invincible. And this is the danger with this law. That's why you are seeing non-Muslims in India also coming out in the street. There are Hindus who are open-minded, Sikhs, Buddhists, Christians, Parsis, etc., because they feel that at the end of the day, if this law gets away, at, you know, what will be next? Today it's Muslims being targeted. Who will be targeted next? And it doesn't have to be only on the basis of religion. There's also, at the end of the day, the there's been accusations that Modi's government is only there to serve the very rich elite of India and to benefit the elite, right? Mm-hmm. And in his previous term, he came out with the demonetization, which caught the nation by surprise. And it really affected a lot of people. So the thing is that if this goes unchecked, right, it's just going to be, again, you know, it's going to be a ripple chain of events that will come up one after the other. And this government is only
six, seven months into running. Yeah, what you are saying is that although it's primarily directed or targeting Muslims, overall, it's mainly a human rights issue.
Oh, definitely it's a human rights issue, without a doubt. And you can see that the people are fed up. You can look, at the end of the day, we must accept the fact that India is a country of 1.3 billion people, of which 900 million are Hindus. You've got 200 million Muslims, and you've got 200 million between Sikhs, Christians, Buddhists, etc., and the other minorities, right? So we have to accept the fact that India is a Hindu-majority country. It is the world's largest democracy. It's supposed to be a secular democracy, a secular constitution. However, just like how we have Muslim countries, if tomorrow a just government wants to pronounce or declare the country as a Hindu nation, nobody can stop it as such per se on principle, provided that they give equal rights to their non-Hindus or the other minorities. And that's what we also like to see in Muslim countries, whereby if they are democracies, they must also, and being a Muslim country with Islam as part of the constitution, as long as they recognize the rights of minorities. So the thing is that...
Right, one more time, very quickly. One more time, Mustafa, very quickly. Okay. Where is it happening, what's happening, and what time?
Okay. Tomorrow, Sunday the 16th of February at 8:45 a.m., we all will start off at the amphitheater on North Beach, which is in front of the Langeni Maharani. We recommend the listeners to park their cars at the Snake Park parking lot, which is very nearby. And as I said, there will be a few short addresses to the crowd, and then we'll have the march and come back to the amphitheater for another set of speeches. And that's the event, inshallah. So we're looking at about, say, from 8:45 to about 11 o'clock, inshallah.
Jazakallah khair for your input there, and good luck, inshallah, with your event.
Okay, jazakallah khair.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wa alaikum salam. Right. So we've come to the end of the program, and we're going to dip into the graveyard of light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I hope you didn't hear this one, but just humor me and laugh along, okay? So Ronnie from Mirbank went into Addington Hospital here in Durban for a piles operation, but he ended up with a cracked skull. How did that happen? Well, after the operation, Ronnie's wife, Pushpa, was sitting at his bedside, waiting for him to wake up. After an hour, Ronnie's eyes flickered and he whispered, "Pushpa, you look so beautiful." And then he drifted back to sleep. After another hour, his eyes flickered open again and he said, "Pushpa, you look nice." And Pushpa replied, "What happened to beautiful?" And Ronnie replied, "I think the anesthetic is wearing off." Okay, let's try one more. Ronnie took his dog to the vet. "Hey, doc, I want you to cut my dog's tail off." The vet was surprised and said, "Hey, Ronnie, why you want to do such a thing?" And Ronnie replied, "Because
my mother-in-law is coming over to my house tomorrow, and I don't want anything to make her think that she is welcome.
enough of this now. And join me for more of the Big Picture Part 2 on Radio Al-Ansar after the 12 o'clock news. This is Amy Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.